Welcome to Threads of Enlightenment, your journey into personal growth. The splendor of any decision is after you've made it, all that remains to be seen are its consequences. My name is Ken Primus. I am your host. Here at Threads of Enlightenment, we talk about the principles of self-development and personal growth. By having conversation with people who have walked through their journey of personal growth. We believe that everyone at some point in their life will have to deal with one or more of these principles to have the privilege of focusing on their self-development as humans. These principles, when applied, can help you to become the best self possible. Welcome to another episode of Threads of Enlightenment. As usual, I like to stop right here because I really do believe that these things are very precious and priceless in many ways. And that is why those that are listening to my podcast hear me say this over and over. It's first to thank the guests for coming and spending quality time. Time is a beautiful commodity. Many of us misuse that valuable resource that is called time. And I want to thank you, Martin, for coming and spending some with us. The other is your journey. It housed who you were and made you who you are today. And so we're excited about that because you're here to share some of this wisdom that you have acquired so that we can become better human spirits while we're here listening and engaging with you. And I thank you for that, sir. Thank you, Martin, for coming to Threads of Enlightenment.
Well, thank you, Ken. I appreciate it, and I'm looking forward to an enlightening conversation with you.
Excellent, sir. Talk to them about those things that you have created, Martin. I love telling people that they are creators, man. I say that because I want to just put a spark within them that there's greatness that is residing there. So talk to us of all those things that you have given birth to as a result of your precious journey that you went through.
Well, thank you for putting it that way. So, and it's actually in what I'm known as the architect of the warrior's life code. An architect is just another word for creator, you know? And for me, it's all about the word life. And life stands for, in my world, live incredibly full every day. And I start my day every day off with this mantra, with this affirmation of today, I live incredibly full every day. And it comes from, you know, I'm now 60. So it comes from 60 years of life experience that got me to the point to realize that I do want to love every day of life. And I have to look at how I got here in the first place.
Yeah. I love it. I'm 61, so I understand. And that's why I stop. And I always thank people for coming and spend that commodity because at this age, I understand the value. And because of my journey, I understand and I appreciate the greatness and beauty of time. Martin, talk to us about your childhood. I like talking about this because to me, it is one of the first, spaces, if you will, that you and I land on this planet after we make our entrance. And in that space, the programming begins. We are being programmed by two individuals that themselves are traumatized. And based on their trauma, they perceive the world based on that. And then they begin to deposit things to us, whatever it is, whether it's good or bad. It's coming. So talk to us about your family. How was that unit like? And what was your first stop, if you will, like as you enter this earth?
That's a great way to put it. So I'm the first son after four girls. And you know, as a matter of fact, so was my father. He was the first son after four girls.
Wow.
And he had a brother afterwards, as I did. 5 years later, I had my brother. And, you know, I come from a Jewish community, and I know this means something all over the world, but even more so in the Jewish community, I believe, is carrying on the legacy of the name, carrying on the legacy of the family, right? Yeah. So having another brother, besides having another male in the household, other than four older sisters, meant that I had my partner. I had the guy that was going to go through life with. Yeah. And I remember when I was a child, I was 10 years old, almost 10 years old. And I found out that my mother was pregnant and I was nervous. And I remember going to school and telling the principal, who, you know, was a very sweet man, I'm nervous. I might have another sister. I don't know how I'm going to handle this. I'm not even 10 years old and I'm worried about this. And he says, you know, all will be okay. And he said, whatever it is, it's what God needs for you to have in your life and it'll be fine.
Yeah.
And it ended up being a son and a brother. And it was fantastic for me and fantastic for my family. And then you talked about a pit stop, right? Yeah. So for me, that pit stop happened. So this was when I was 5 years old that my brother was born. Okay. So I was a little baby. I was a boy. I was just starting school. So 5 years later, I'm 10 years old and we had a tragedy and my brother was killed by a school bus.
Wow.
And it was, you know, it rocked me. It rocked my family. I mean, we were distraught. What happened was he got off the school bus. We found out later that these were the details. Got off the school bus, walked in front of the bus, dropped something. And as a five-year-old, he does what a five-year-old does. He reached down to pick it up.
Wow.
And the bus driver looked over, saw nothing, thought my brother was already on the sidewalk, and drove.
Wow.
He didn't mean anything by it, of course.
Yeah.
And 4 days later, my brother, you know, succumbed to his injuries and passed away. And that, I find that as a defining moment in my life. Now, it took me many years to recognize that.
Yeah.
Okay. But as a 10-year-old, looking at my life and realizing, oh, I'm the only boy. It's my job to now be the one that continues on the legacy, as we discussed, I said earlier. It's my job to make sure that my parents don't feel pain like this again, right? Any kind of pain.
Yeah.
And at that moment, looking back now, I realized I became a people pleaser.
Mm-hmm.
But it took me another 40 years to realize that when I became a people pleaser, it brought a lot of baggage.
Yeah.
As well as looking back now, I was a people pleaser that wasn't pleasing anybody.
Yeah. It is funny how I've noticed this through the conversations that I've had with people, is that the thing that we use to help us through the trauma, because that is a traumatic situation, the tool that you and I will grab onto, that tool that seem appropriate at the time, pleasing people, making sure that everyone is okay and all of those things, that is the same sword, if you will, that turns around and wounds us because we haven't, for whatever reason it is, Martin, that weapon that we use, and I hate to use that, but it becomes that against us, but we used it at the beginning of the trauma as a way by which we can cope with the trauma.
Right. We and use it as a tool only to learn later that it really is a weapon.
Yes.
And it's a weapon not only for against others, against ourselves, even more than that.
More than anyone else, it is a weapon of self-destruction that we had been wielding for so many years. And we wield it by the decisions that we made prior, after that, to govern our lives. So as a young man, with this tremendous trauma, and I know the burden that it comes on with the on top of that trauma, the responsibility that this young man now puts on himself because of being that male to carry the lineage. I understand all of that aspect of it because now you have to grow up a little faster than, and this is self-inflicted. Has nothing to do with anyone else. So talk to me about this particular space right there, Martin. How did you start to govern yourself and your surroundings? Because you mentioned you became a people pleaser, but how did you do that? What did it look like as a young 10-year-old?
Yeah. So Ken, for me, it looked like, okay, so here I am. My parents are distraught. They're very sad. I mean, they've had a tragedy in their life that no one should ever feel. No one should ever see the child, the loss of a child. Okay. And I'm saying to myself, it's my job now to make sure that they're happy, that they never seem pain, any kind of, because they've already felt what I could look back now and say is one of the ultimate types of pain, the loss of a child, right? So it's my job as another child in the family to protect them, to shield them from other pain by taking on the role of whatever they say, I'm going to listen to mm-hmm. because that will make them happy.
Yeah.
So, you know, I went through life, I would want to become different things. And my parents are like, no, you'll go into business. You'll become a businessman. You want to go into theater? No, that's not for you. You want to become a photographer? No, there's no money there. You got to have a stable job, stable life. And I'm like, okay, you know, you guys know best. And I want to please you. So I became that people pleaser. And as I got married, it continued. Now I'm not only trying to please my parents and my family, I'm also trying to please my wife. Mm-hmm. And what I developed as a result of being a people pleaser were a lot of underlying things that took me literally 40 years to recognize that was the turning point. That was the defining moment. I became a people pleaser, as I said. I took things personally.
Yeah.
I was a control freak. And then on top of all that, had a very short temper, which all makes sense. Because as a people pleaser, if I'm not pleasing everybody, then I'm taking it personally. And if things aren't happening the way I think it is supposed to happen as a control freak, then I'm not pleasing anybody. And if all that's happening, the last thing I got to do is make sure that people are going to take what I say as being the right thing and losing it.
Because you know what's best for them as
that's
you.
That's it. Exactly.
So talk to me about this guy, because he's growing up, and we'll get back to the marriage piece. He's 10 and he's moving in his age and he's dealing with high school. And how did you manage your relationship with those around you in high school being a people pleaser? And how was your studies and all of those things? Because all of that does make a play within the self-development, the purpose, purposeful self-development. Talk to us about that.
Okay. So one of the things I did was in my mindset, I said, you know, I think I want to become a doctor, even a pediatrician, because, you know, to save children.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And I didn't know at the time. I know now that I'm ADD, ADHD, actually. So that didn't help much. And I was always a pretty good student in school. But I would get involved in a lot of community projects, community organizations, because that's what my parents were doing. So I was following my parents' footsteps, getting involved in community organizations because I wanted to make my parents happy and, you know, because I was following their footsteps in that way. But I also was trying to make sure that I was helping others and making them happy as well.
Yeah.
My motive for it, my deep down motive for it was to make others happy and really get the recognition I needed to serve that people pleaser side.
Yeah.
The people pleaser want, for me, as I look at it, needs recognition. They need to know that people are saying, Martin, what a great job you're doing. And as you get that, now you're feeding your ego. You're feeding what's going on. So you want to do more and you want to do more, even if it's for good. And I did a lot of good. I mean, I started a synagogue in New Jersey, the first synagogue in the town of Eatontown. At the time, we only, you know, this was in my 30s, my late 20s, 30s. We end up, you know, we need 10 men to have a service in the Jewish religion. Every Saturday morning, we'd go around to the houses. Guys, we need you. Come on. We need 10 guys. I'm very proud to say, I mean, I moved away years later as we were building it. I was the founder, the president of the synagogue for about 14, 15 years. Now there's over 400 families and they're expanding into a bigger place. So that's a beautiful thing. Yeah. But I loved being the leader because I was being recognized for the things that I was doing. So I can turn back and say, look what I've done. Mm-hmm. Look at the beauty I've done. And a lot of it I came back to realize later is, especially in my family, I would do things, try to make my wife happy, try to make my father happy, my mother happy, so on and so forth, that I would rationalize that all the things I was doing was for the greater good, even if it didn't agree with me deep down inside. And I've since taken the word rationalize and I've basically trademarked it into two words.
Yeah.
Rational lies. I lie to myself and people lie to themselves that when they're doing something that goes against their core values or their inner beliefs, because they think it's going to be good for something else.
Yeah.
It's rational to do these things.
Yeah. I call them, I said to myself, because I had some of those issues that I'm tired of being a martyr because I find myself dying every time I was doing something to help someone else. And I was putting myself aside and it would turn around and it would blow up, Martin. And I would go into this little thing where I'm like, I'm never going to help anyone. And And then the next thing you know, I'm helping somebody and all this kind of stuff. Exactly. So it was a perpetual cycle that you found yourself in and having to learn how to get out of this pit that you have created. So here you are, you're going through all of these things and you're moving through in life in college now. I want to know, Martin, what study did you take, if you did, and why?
So I did go to college. And along the way, I told you I wanted to be a doctor. Mm-hmm. But when I was in high school and I took the SAT, I walked out of the SAT and I said, yeah, I didn't do well on this. I'm not a good test taker. That's it. You know, I'm not going to become a doctor. And I rationalized that I couldn't do it because I didn't have good study skills when I was a child. And the teachers never taught me the right way to do homework. I was the worst homework doer in the world. My parents would come home, can't you ever do your homework? So when I got into college, I was already on the path to go into business. Okay? Mm-hmm. My father had a business and that was the way so I became an economics major. And the main reason I became an economics major was because I went to Brooklyn College, mm-hmm. which was local. It was a mile and a half away from my home. I live in Brooklyn, New York.
Queens,
man. I took economics. Sorry? Uh-huh.
Queens.
Oh, there you go.
Queens Village.
There you go. So the reason I took economics as my major was because it was the least amount of credits I needed to qualify. And then everything else could be liberal arts. In the business world, I couldn't, to become an accountant, I needed another 20 or 30 credits in that area. And I was like, I don't want to be an accountant anyway.
So. So here you are, you got your stuff in college, because I know as you are this young man, talk to us about how were you formed now that you've gone through some years from being 10 years old, that particular incident that began to form you and created who you are today. You're sitting in college. You are looking at the curriculum and go, 20 more credits for accountant. No way. So talk to me about how this young man is managing his life, if you will, and still being in that state and that mindset of pleasing.
So I basically was, let me take the easy way through college.
Yeah.
That's what I was. I was taking the easy way. And I had already said, I'll work 2-3 days a week and I'll go to school 2-3 days.
Yeah.
And by then, my father had closed his business, opened a different business that there really wasn't any place for me, which was fine, and opened up and went into business with somebody else in a separate business with the ideas of me being the other person's partner in that business, which is what I was for a few years. And really what that, and the gentleman that was my partner was a good 15 to 20 years older than me. Mm-hmm. So he basically replaced my father in a father figure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I wanted to please him just as much as I wanted to please my father. And I was, he said to me, you must finish college. That's one of my requirements when I decided to go into business with your dad, is that you have to go to college, you have to finish, and you could go to school and go to work at the same time and do that whole thing. So that started to really start to form my mindset of, okay, I'm in business. I'm going to become, because every day I had off from school when I was a kid, my father's factory, or the first factory he had, was a mile and a half away from home. So my mother was like, go to work with dad. Go to work. Yeah. Go to work with dad. Any day off from school, go to work. And I, looking back now, it was probably because I was ADHD and she wanted me out of her hair.
So here you are. You met this young woman and you guys got married.
Yeah.
And you're still walking through the pain. You're still formulating your life. And I tell people this thing will follow us for a while until it is time, in the fullness of time, as we read in the Bible that Adonai didn't move until the fullness of time. So talk to us in your life, Martin, as you're moving through, you're pleasing your life. Life is doing good. Of course, all life is always doing good,
right? Until it's not.
And then I was reading your stuff where 2008 was a beautiful year, because I remember that personally some of the things that happened to me as well. Talk to us about your life and your mindset at that time as you're moving through where you are now afforded the second major, if you will, disturbance or visitation within your life that shook your world. Talk to us a little about that.
All right. So let me lead up to it a little bit first so that it gives it a better understanding as to what happened in 2008 to me.
Yeah.
As a ripple effect as to what happened in the rest of the world. I was part of the ripple effect of 2008.
Yeah.
So a few years earlier, I had closed a business and I had a residual income coming in. So if I never worked again, I was okay. I was okay. Yeah. I had money coming in that was good enough for me to have a pretty decent life. Mm-hmm. But my wife's like, you know what? I really don't want you sitting around doing nothing all the time. And she says, I'm having difficulty. We were living in New Jersey at the time, down by the Jersey Shore. Mm-hmm. She goes, I'm having difficulty. I just started playing tennis and I'm having difficulty finding tennis courts available for tennis lessons and so on. She said, it's just, there's just not enough courts around. Mm-hmm. We should look into opening up a tennis club. I was like, okay, the people pleaser in me. Okay. She wants this. I want to make her happy. Let's look into it. So I said, okay, we're going to be very, very logical in this. We'll go get a feasibility study. Yeah. We'll do all the right steps and so on and so forth, which is the way it started out. So we go and get the feasibility study and they go, yeah, there is a need for tennis courts, but the tennis court business won't be enough to sustain a good enough income. You have to have other income with it. Mm-hmm. Like, what are you talking about? Well, it's good to have a health club and it's good to build up a whole thing and build it around it. So this was like early 2000s. 2003, 2004, something like that. So we went on this journey to find a place, do the research, do all that stuff. And by the time we got to 2008, we had put in over $3 million worth of pre-work to build a, what would be a $15 million tennis club, health club with a pool, basketball courts, full gym, full workout gym, spa, you name it. It'd be over 100,000 square feet. It'd be massive. And don't forget, if you remember that time, 2005, 6, 7, you would go to the bank and say, I want money. And they'd say, okay.
How much?
How much?
Yeah.
We're good. Whatever it is.
Yeah.
Because, you know, at the time, subprime loans were like, okay, whatever. We'll figure it out later. You know. So great. Beautiful. So we finally get all the approvals from the city, from the state and everything. And I'm putting my money in. I'm putting money on borrowing. I'm putting money, my money in and my residual money and all that. So I'm over $3.5 million because I'm saying, great, everything's working great. I'm even getting to the point that the architects are done. The architect work is done. The engineering is starting to get done. So as soon as we get approval, I can go in the ground.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm you know, getting a running start. And we go to the bank in the summer of 2008. They go, yeah, lending isn't what it used to be. So we're not going to lend you the money. I'm like, what are you talking about? Well, we don't know. Things are going to happen. And they really said more than that, but I'll leave it. So now it comes to September 2008. And this little guy comes along. His name is Bernie Madoff.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, the financial world crashes.
Yeah.
And all these subprime loans crash. And the world is turned upside down.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I have all this money that I put in and I borrowed and all that. What am I going to do now? And overnight, I saw it coming for a month because they had already told me. But I was still trying. I was still going out there, going to other banks, doing looking for other investors, all that. All that went away. And overnight, I was broke. Wow. Imagine a couple of weeks later, a couple of months later, I stopped paying my mortgage almost right away. Mm-hmm. I stopped paying my car payments. Imagine waking up, Dad, they're towing away our car. I was being repossessed.
Yeah.
The house was foreclosed on. It took a little while for the house foreclosure because there was enough foreclosures to keep every state busy. But New Jersey, for some reason, really dragged their feet, which was good in a way.
Yeah.
But our house was foreclosed on and I had nothing. It was down to zero. So this was another defining moment that I could look back and say, this was the turning point.
Yeah.
And it took me about a year to pick myself off the ground. I was literally in a depression.
Yeah.
I went to therapists. I went to all that and realized I was in a situational depression, as were many other people because they lost everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it took me a year to finally recognize, okay, it's up to me to now move forward and figure out what's going to happen. And go ahead.
What? Right there. I want you to stop right there, Martin, because that's a pivotal point as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
What brought you to the space, to the mindset that, wait a minute, I need to pick myself up? What was it that, if you could remember, I know the length of time, and what it was doing, the depression and all of those things. What was it in that same depression and those dark spaces that made you go, wait a minute, I need to get up?
Yeah. I would say that I was lucky because I was in therapy. Mm-hmm. And I was having, with a social worker, but still, yeah. He was a therapist. He was somebody who I could go to and talk to and work through things. And he finally said, okay, you've done all the work here to recognize what's your fault, what's not your fault, what you can fix, what you can't fix. So where are you going to go now? Mm-hmm. So that was my turn to say, okay, it's my decision now. I can't blame anybody else. I can't continue to blame the world for what happened.
Yeah.
It's not serving me. So I got to figure things out. So I looked back over my life and I realized all those times I was in the community events and they were successful. Part of why they were successful was me, right? Mm-hmm. But also because I knew how to get out of people more than they thought they could give.
Mm-hmm.
I realized I was coaching them.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was like, oh, wow. I've been coached in the past. I've done some business coaching, had some business coaches and life coaches. And it was still an early thing. People didn't realize what those things were.
Yeah.
But I was always looking for stuff like that. So it's like, oh, wow, maybe I could become a life coach because I didn't want to be in business anymore. I was tired of the rat race of business. I was tired of the roller coaster of emotions and financials that go through with being in business.
Yeah. There's a gentleman that Earl Nightingale talks about, Acres of Diamonds.
Mm-hmm.
And powerful story, but all of us are that story. Because I believe that, Martin, that diamond field, the richness of the diamond field resides in every single one of us. But because we get busy, and even in the busyness of life, we tend to not go deep until something happens to some of us that are gifted in it. And then when we realize, as your therapist said, and I always tell people, get help. Don't be prideful where you miss your visitation because you don't want to seek help. Everyone needs help. And so find it and get it. They are simply there to help you see you. So don't panic. Don't panic and say nothing crazy. They're just here to help you out. And so I believe, Martin, all of us are that diamond. I believe that we operate within our gifts, but we sometimes don't take the time to recognize that we are. And I'm so glad that you did do that because I want to point it out to a lot of people. The gift resides in you and you've been doing it for a long time. You just didn't know how to clarify it and how to speak to it. So once you identified it, Martin, talk to me as to how did you begin to do what's necessary to acquire, as they say, the certification and all the other things. Where did you start searching? What does that look like when back in the day when there was nothing like that per se? Right.
Exactly. Well, luckily there was some of it around. But, I want to touch on something you mentioned. It's so true that, it's okay to go out and ask for help, especially men. They don't recognize it's okay. They look at it as a weakness. It's not.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But for me, I looking back now, I recognize I needed therapy at the time because I was in a dysfunctional mode.
Yeah.
And I needed to get back to being functional.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And once I became functional, I needed something that said, okay, I don't want to do what I'm doing anymore. I want to live out my potential. I didn't know what that meant at the time, but I wanted to do something that was helpful to others while helping myself in the process.
Yeah.
And going back now, when I started in the coaching school that I went to, and I'll get to in a minute what that is and how that pastor was, I learned a very interesting thing that therapy takes you from dysfunctional to functional, okay, which is a great thing and very necessary for many people.
Yeah.
And coaching takes you from functional to optimal.
Yes.
Right? So now, how did I find the school? Well, thank God for the internet. I start typing in life coaching.
Yeah.
What is life coaching? How do you find life coaching? What kind of schools are there? And as I'm typing, at the time I was living in New Jersey, mm-hmm. I recognized that the same school keeps coming up.
Yeah.
And it's called IPEC. It's Institute for Professional Excellence in Coaching. And all of a sudden I look, they're 2 miles away from my home in New Jersey.
Wow.
They're headquarters. They do satellite teaching all over the country and now even all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I was like, okay, let me look into this. And as I looked into it, there were two that I was looking at. One was a little more clinical. Yeah. And I wasn't into the clinical side of it. And this one was more about an energy, you know, getting into the understanding the different levels of energy that are within you.
Yes.
And that was speaking to me. So I was like, okay. So I contact the company, I speak to the people there, you know, and whatever. And then they said, this is how much it's going to cost. And I was like, whoa, I don't have money. They go, well, we have ways for you to be able to get it financed. I'm like, yeah, nobody's going to finance me. So it was only 2 miles away from my home.
Yeah.
So I call up the CFO and I said, look, I live a few miles away from you. Can I come in and talk to you?
Yeah.
He says, yeah. I go in. I explained to him my situation. And I said, listen, I don't have much, but I want this. Mm-hmm. And I'll do whatever I can and take however long it takes to pay you.
Yeah.
And he said, I'll make you a deal. You keep paying us a little bit every month. And when you're finished paying, then you could get your certification.
Mm-hmm.
I said, that's a fair deal. Because if I got my certification before I finished paying, some guys may say, well, I got my certification. Screw them. I wouldn't have been that person. But as a businessman, he's got to think like that.
Yeah.
So I'm like, in, done, let's do it. And then I went. And then this was a few months before coaching was going to start. And then I got hit with another defining moment before I even went into coaching. All right. So they kept on coming.
They kept coming, man.
Kept on coming. So now is my 24th wedding anniversary. Okay. And we got married on February 15th, the day after Valentine's Day.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's our 24th wedding anniversary. And we've been through some tough times the last few years.
Yeah.
She turns to me. She said, I'm done. I want a divorce.
Wow.
I mean, I kind of knew it was coming, but until you ever actually hear those words, you never believe it's really going to happen.
Yeah.
Every emotion you could imagine, I had. Anger, despair, fear, sadness. What am I going to do now?
Yeah.
Lack of self-worth came back. Yeah. All that energy that I was working on rebuilding myself drained because here I am, the one person that I thought loved me didn't love me anymore.
Yeah.
Right. And I didn't want to get divorced. And I was like, I'll figure this out. So part of me is like, maybe I should have turned to her and said, but I didn't get you anything like that for our anniversary. But looking back now, other than our four children, it was the greatest gift she ever gave me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it was another eye opener. It was another time I was down on the ground, knocked down again, say, am I going to get up or am I going to roll into a ball and just cry and do nothing? But I already decided I was going to become a life coach. So there was a little part of me that said, oh, maybe this will help me. And then I can help my wife and we can figure out how to get the marriage going.
Yeah, that's natural.
Yeah, but it didn't happen. And it was the best thing to not happen because going so that a few months later, I started coaching school and it was a weekend. And that first weekend, they say, before you could start to coach others, you got to figure out what's going on in yourself.
Yeah.
And they gave us a list of books to read and they said, pick two or three of them. Read them before you start. Read them all if you want, but just read two or three. And one of them was called The Four Agreements.
Yeah. Great
book. You ever read that book?
Yeah, I read it.
Life changing for me.
Yeah.
And I read the second agreement to anybody in the audience who doesn't know what that is. It's don't take anything personally.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, that's an interesting concept. I've always taken everything personally. The world is on my shoulders. And it was as if Don Miguel Ruiz, who is recovering from heart transplant surgery.
Yeah.
Thank God. May he live many, many more years.
Yeah.
As if Don Miguel Ruiz was talking to me
directly
and giving me a secret that the world had been telling me my entire life.
Mm-hmm.
But until that moment, I wasn't ready to hear it.
Yeah.
And he presented it in a way, and I was in a position to say, oh my God.
Yeah.
I don't have to take things personally.
Yeah.
Which then started the process. That was just the turning on the switch of the light.
Mm-hmm.
Now it was up to me to see if the light was going to stay on or if I was going to let it dim.
Yeah. I tell a story because I grew up in the church. I tell a story about this woman with the issue of blood in the Bible. And this woman is a woman of means, Martin. She had money. And she believed so much so in the healthcare system of the day that she spent her money. She went, you know, going to all the doctors and seeking out care because she was dying, you know. And but there was this young man in her neighborhood and he was out healing people and so forth, but she didn't need him. Her focus, her energy was on another system, her faith, her belief system. And there was nothing she could have probably stand right in front of him and hear him talk, and she just wasn't ready because her faith was not there. It was somewhere else. And so she got into the other system, found out, wait a minute, I'm broke and I got nothing left. And so she's sitting down, just, you know, probably was in our living room and decided I need to go for a walk. And she heard somebody said, hey, there's this other system down the road. This young man, people are getting healed. And so she looked at herself and she said, she looked at this darkness and go, I'm dying anyway. I got nothing to lose.
Nothing to lose.
And so many of us, because Jesus makes a statement, he says, those who have ears, let them hear. So he's talking about a different ear. And so, but you have to be in a situation that what I learned from that was that there is a responsibility upon the hearer to make him or herself ready to hear about that information, because the truth is always out there. It's there in different form. Miguel wrote several powerful books.
Yes.
They're in books. They're all over the place around people all the time, but many of them got their faith somewhere else and they're not ready for it. And here you are. You got that insight because that is the beginning of wisdom. It is the beginning of your beginnings, I call it. So talk to me as that thing crept in, because I tell people the beauty about books, when you sit down and you read them, they have this ability, the words have this ability to jump inside you and change everything. So you got this word just jumped into the pages, from the pages jumped into your being. What did it do to you and where did it usher you to?
Right. So once I started to internalize that I didn't have to take things personally, I looked over my life where it was at the time. And it wasn't in a great state, but at least I was starting to move on in my life. And I was like, okay, what are the things that I'm doing now that are contributing negatively?
Yeah.
What are the things that I'm doing? Okay, so if I'm taking things personally, how could I not take them personally?
Yeah.
Now, of course, I'd love to think that at that moment, I stopped taking things personally. It's not that way. It's a journey.
A lifetime, man. It's a lifetime.
Lifetime journey.
Yeah.
And also the other three agreements are just as important, you know, be impeccable with your words, don't make assumptions, and always do your best. They're also, all four of them are powerful. Okay. So I started to say, okay, how about if when someone tells me something, I think about why are they saying it? Because I learned something in coaching school.
Yeah.
What someone says to you is about them.
Yeah.
What you hear them say is about you.
Yes.
So that means, okay, when someone tells me you're a piece of garbage, I'm using a cleaner word than I would ordinarily, is it that I'm a piece of garbage or something's going on in their life and they're taking it out on me?
Yeah.
Okay. And am I taking the blame for it?
Yeah.
Am I taking being responsible? Am I taking it personally? And I started to shift that energy slowly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I tell a story about how, looking back now, as I was getting divorced, I needed to start to understand that I had to there were hot buttons that we all have in a relationship.
Yeah.
Whether people know it or not, they could push a hot button. So my ex, whether she knew it or not, we were still going through the divorce process, would call me up and say a very simple statement. I don't want to fight, but that clicked in my head.
Yeah.
She's calling me up. She wants to fight.
Yeah.
Let's get ready to rumble.
Yeah.
Because it meant, okay, we're going to fight. And I would start the fight because I would react. I was taking it personally.
Yeah.
And then it was easy for her to say, you started the fight. I told you I didn't want to fight. So once I was aware of this, as opposed to being self-conscious and saying, okay, she's getting me to a fight. And one of the things I talk about in my course is self-conscious versus self-aware, okay, which is a whole mind shift.
Difference,
but
yeah.
once I became started to become aware of it, I learned that I needed to recondition myself and her without her realizing she was being reconditioned. Oh, like, kind of like Pavlov's dogs.
Yeah.
And for a bunch of times I would say, oh, you don't want to start a fight? I'm hanging up.
Yeah.
And I would hang up on her because that was my first reaction.
Yeah.
As opposed to, so it was fight or flight in the beginning.
Yeah.
I'm going to fight or I'm going to walk away from it.
Yeah.
And then she's like, why do you keep hanging up? I said, because you don't want to fight. And I know that if we continue this conversation, I'm going to fight.
Yeah.
So I'm stopping the fight. And I started to build my awareness around it.
Yeah.
And shifted from reacting to eventually responding.
Yes. Yes. That is a beautiful shift when that happens, because the entrance of peace, the entrance of self-control is a powerful thing that when one, start to begin to control their thoughts, because the thoughts, I tell people, is the first defense in the battlefield. If you win there, you're in control of the war.
That's right. It's a huge part of my course is taking control of your emotions instead of them controlling you.
Yeah. And as you began to talk, what were some of those tools as you began to use to begin to gain mastery of yourself, to become one that is able to master their thoughts, in the sense of, I tell people, you have to learn how to slow it down.
Right, exactly.
Because once you begin to slow the thoughts down, you are then looking for reasons as to why it's here.
Yeah.
What is my response that it triggers? You began to have this internal conversation. So as you began to do that, what were some of the tools, Martin, did you bring into your space to
can
help
I, can
you
I kind
do
of
that?
Feel like you've taken my course? Because I'll tell you what, you remember when we were kids or when our children were in school. I don't know if you have children, but my kids went to school.
I have five
and
boys.
And the fireman comes into the class to teach them fire safety. Yeah. And he teaches them three words when there's a fire. To remember these three words when a fire happens. Do you remember that?
I missed it, man.
Okay. Well, the three words that the fireman teaches the kids is stop, drop, and roll. Stop what you're doing. Drop to the floor under the smoke and roll away.
Yeah.
So I said to myself, I'm the guy who, when there's a fire, I start running around in the smoke trying to figure things out.
Yeah.
Trying to stop the fire, even if it's out of control. That's my reaction. So now I got to figure out how to do that. So I took that metaphor and said, let me start. I didn't even realize it at the time. And now I've developed it into part of my course. I took the three words, stop, drop, and roll, and changed them to stop, think, and respond when I'm in a situation that I would usually react.
Yeah.
Stop in the moment. And instead of reacting, stop.
Yeah.
Think, is this something I need to react to? Am I taking it personally? Is it about me or is it about them? Or something completely separate from both of us?
Yeah.
You know, is there literally a fire going on?
Yeah.
And respond. Instead of going, blah, 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 crazy, bring down your emotions. Bring down that initial innate feeling that you have to change to reacting and losing it all and then picking up the pieces later, shoot and ask questions later.
Yeah.
Instead, ask questions. And then instead of shooting a bullet, shoot some love.
Yeah. I call it purposeful decision making.
Beautiful. Love it.
Because what happens is we are making decisions when we are unaware. And when we are not awake or when we are asleep, we are in a perpetual decision-making lifestyle. That's what we do.
Yeah.
But when it becomes purposeful, it becomes sweet because you began to see things. You began to make adjustments. You begin to understand, if you will. And as you begin to become more aware and understand and these things, this beautiful dance begins to take place with you personally is that you begin to expand. You begin to be able to love those that you couldn't stand their voices. You begin to, you begin to expand, Martin. And it's really an interesting phenomenon to watch because you will go back after you are with that person. You go, wow, I can't believe I didn't lose it. I can't believe. And so you are expanding as you begin to become purposeful design making, I call it, where you
know. But it's an evolution. It's not something that happens quickly.
It took
and I don't want the audience to think that was it. It took me one time. I got it. I was like, oh, that's it. Oh, no.
It is. You're learning. I call it one of the things that I tell people. You have to understand the purpose of the reason why someone comes into your life. They are there to make you aware of your scotomas, your blind side, your behavior that you're so accustomed to that you don't even know that it's there.
Yeah.
Until someone turns to you and said, you know what? You are a blank, blank, blank. And then you have to take that information, and when you are not living in the present, your first instinct is to cuss him out, because that was my first instinct. I said, what exactly. do you mean? And blah, blah, blah.
What the heck do you think yep. you are?
Until, Martin, I understood the purpose of that statement that they made. It is to make me better if I take it and use it right, correctly. And so I started doing that. And as you said, it is a beautiful place to be. So when you got yeah. there, Martin, because I know it's going to lead you down to where you are today.
Yeah.
So as you began to move in that space and you began to incorporate all of these principles in your life, now with this new glasses on, if you will, this new perspective,
right.
when that first person came into your space and you began to now become and walk in the shoe of a servant, I know you haven't gotten your quote unquote title yet, but you're doing it.
Yeah.
And then one day it hits you and then you go, wait a minute. So talk to me as you began to walk in that direction. And when you began.
Yeah. I think it started with my kids because, you know, they were used to me being the guy, the safety net.
Yeah.
Okay. They never had, because I never wanted them to feel pain.
Yeah.
So I would always be the control freak. Almost like, you know, they talk about the helicopter parents, helicopter mother being on top of
yeah, yeah.
I guess I was kind of like that.
Mm-hmm.
And because now I wasn't in their circle anymore so closely, because I moved out during the divorce and a couple of them got yeah. married and a couple of them were still there and I was only seeing them. And I was going through this metamorphosis, as it were.
Yeah.
Right. I was coming out of my chrysalis.
Yes.
Words are coming to me today, you know. But I was like, they would have something happen and they wouldn't tell me about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I would find out about it, instead of reacting, I was like, you know, I'm curious, how come you didn't tell me about this? Well, yeah. Because your first thing would be to freak out and then to yeah. take control.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. Yeah. And then they were like, what do you mean that's interesting?
Hmm.
You mean you're not going to freak out on me now that I didn't tell you?
Yeah.
No, I'm not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
And things started to get better because they saw that I was evolving, as I used the word before.
Yeah.
And you know, they were afraid to come to me because they knew I was like, how could you let this happen?
Yeah.
But you know what? Looking back now, I wish I had this when they were kids, when they were little.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. they needed to go through those things and figure it out on their own
yeah.
so that they could become stronger people for themselves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
It is.
So, So that was the beginning of it.
Yeah.
And as I started to get more into understanding and coaching others,
mm-hmm.
I started in my coaching with telling my clients stories about my life
mm-hmm.
and who I was as a result of it and who I am now. Looking yeah. back over it.
Yeah.
And I realized that the reason why I could be an effective coach was because I wasn't just telling them things that I didn't understand. I was coaching them around stuff that I understood so I can tell them and I could show them examples of what happens if.
Yeah.
And as I did that, I was like, whoa, I came up with stop, think, and respond. I look back now. I said, oh, that's what yeah. I was doing. Let me call it something.
Yeah.
And I started to put my program together based on the things that I was doing and saying, yeah. okay. And then I was enjoying life. I was enjoying things I was doing. I started losing weight. I started yeah. eating better and stuff like that. And I was allowing myself to be coached because a while I wasn't. And then I realized I need yeah. to get back into that because it's a bigger story. And I was loving what I was doing to the point that I said, I like myself.
Yeah.
I finally realized that for the first 50 years of my life, I didn't like myself or even come close to loving myself.
Yeah.
Now I was. Yeah. So I was doing all those things and the exercise really started the endorphins going and got mm-hmm. me going into wanting to eat better, wanting to read better, continue that journey.
Yeah.
I stalled for a little while.
Yeah.
And then I said, okay, let me get back on track. We all have stops and goes. It's never straight up. It's
yeah.
never straight up. There's always a little bit of roller coaster. What we try to do in coaches is to minimize the ups
yes.
and downs
yeah.
with our clients.
Yeah, I tell people a plane never goes in a straight direction. There's no way. I mean, that's why you have the instruments
right.
And the compass, because it will go off course. But that's okay. Your destination is still ahead. It's still going.
But the next time it happens, how are you going to respond instead of react?
Yeah. And you got to become purposeful.
That's where the coaching goes.
You got to become purposeful. All of your decision making becomes, comes from this place of awareness as to what it does to you and how it affects you. And from that space, it will guide you as to your communication with others, because you're looking first at your communication with yourself, which is the most important thing. I remember having this interview with this, this young lady a few days ago, and she said that she remember being in the plane, Martin, and when the plane tells them to put the oxygen on their face first, she was like, you know, she couldn't believe that they would do that when the kids are here and all this kind of stuff. And she said, not until she went through her journey did she understand what that principle is all about. And so once she got it, she can now say, wow, it makes much more sense for me to do that than to do it the way that I was thinking. So here you are, you began to walk through, you got your titles, you got all the stuff going on, because I know when that happens to you, man. And I tell people, it is at this place, Martin, where you have just described, that I believe we truly begin to live.
Yes.
Before that, I believe we are, those that are on the journey, moving to the space that you described, that's what life is about. And when you get there, I'd say to people, everything becomes different. The wind, the noise from the dark, from the dog and the cat and the birds and the, everything has this beautiful sound to it. Mm-hmm. Life, your heart, the way you eat, the way you walk, everything changes, because it is at that space that you have walked in, you become a servant, and you are in a perpetual space of joy, and life becomes flavorful. Here you are, Martin, you've done these things. Talk to me. Pull out I always like to go here for a little while. Pull out a story when someone comes to you, that one of your disciples, I call them. Some people say, clients, your disciples that come in as they are sitting by your feet, and you began to talk to them. And when they got that revelation, when they make that perspective, and because when you and I get to experience that type of voyeurism, it is ecstasy beyond words. Talk to me about someone that you have walked through that were in that dark place, and then the light goes on, and where they are today.
Okay, how about if I read something that somebody wrote about me?
Yeah, go ahead.
With me. So his name is Joshua. Okay, it says, when I started working with Martin, I was ready to give up all hope of living a happy life. Mm-hmm. I thought this was my last shot, and that if it didn't work, I would give up and become a tool for other people's happiness. Oh. I didn't understand that I had internal limiting beliefs and rational lies. He uses my word in this. That were keeping me tied to my old way of thinking. Yeah. Since I started working with Martin, I have gained positive clarity on life. I've accepted my own power and choice. I've taken responsibility for my choices and let go of those choices that were not mine. I have decided to live in abundance and gratitude. Because of these changes Martin taught me, I am happier. I have better relationships, and I have more clients because I am being my real positive self. Looking back, all I wanted was hope that I could start to heal. Needless to say, I have that now.
That is it. That is what I believe, Martin. Every one of us on this planet, every male, every female, is called to live from the place of servanthood. Mm-hmm. There is nothing when you serve your fellow man and walk hand in hand and to be able to assist. You talk about being able to comfort them from a position of where you were comforted. And when you have been in that space and you're able to serve from that place, it becomes powerful, because you, as I said to people, some people have what is called the theory, but not many have the lab experience with that theory. But when you have that combination, your thesis will be some powerful thing to touch and hold and read and to partake of. And that's what you have done.
Thank
so
you.
Anyone that and everyone that's been listening to this beautiful conversation with Martin, I want you guys to get into his space, get to his space. I will put those things together so that you can reach him, get into his classes, get into the space where he can now help you like he did Joshua to see the greatness that is within you so mm-hmm. that you can become more effective for yourself. And being that, you can be effective for your family, your neighbor, your clients, and the world. Yeah. I want you guys to get in touch with our warrior life code developer and attach yourself to him so that he can guide you through so that you can become the best human spirits while you're here on this planet Earth. Martin, thank you so much, sir.
Thank you so much, Ken. It's been a pleasure.
Everyone who's listening to this broadcast, we hope to continually help you to learn how to embrace moments of darkness, because it is in the darkness that we learn how to develop and use our abilities to truly see those parts of ourselves, often invisible to us, in the light. It becomes your responsibility to navigate through all of your trials, to find out who you truly are and begin your journey to loving yourself, which is possibly one of the most difficult things you will ever do in your life. To love yourself and to find the real you. But always remember to enjoy the journey. Thank you for coming by. Please subscribe. And if you can support us financially, we deeply appreciate it. Until next time, invite your family, friends, neighbors, anyone that you can. You can hear us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Apple Music, iHeartRadio, CastBox, Overcast, and many more.